Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Take Aim, Accuracy in Media's weekly talk show on Blog Talk Radio. I am Roger Aronoff, and my co-host is Don Irvine, the chairman of Accuracy in Media. We urge you to visit our website at aim.org and sign up to receive our daily emails to help keep track of what the mainstream media are up to and what they are ignoring. And let me just tell you something about next week's show. We have a special guest, Michelle Malkin, about her new book, The Culture of Corruption. But in the meantime, we have a great show coming up today. We're going to be looking at investigative reporting, and we have one of the greats who has done many, many books on such an array of subjects. It's amazing when I introduce him what you will find out about him. The first guest is going to be Ronald Kessler, and he has a new book out called In the President's Secret Service, Behind the Scenes with Agents in the Line of Fire and the Presidents They Protect. More about him in a minute. And then later on in the hour, we're going to have Todd Shepard of the Independence Institute, and it's more of a grassroots investigative reporter. So we will be on here shortly. So anyway, let me start by telling you a little bit about our guest, Ronald Kessler. I think it is fair and accurate to say that no author, living or dead, has so thoroughly analyzed and gained access to and the trust of the most powerful and secretive institutions in the world. Now, I know that may sound like an overstatement, but consider this. After working as an investigative reporter and editorial writer for the Boston Herald, he joined the Wall Street Journal as a reporter in 1968. Then he became an investigative reporter with the Washington Post in 1970 and continued as a staff writer there until 1985. Since then, he has written an incredible series of books. After a book exposing the life insurance industry and another about the then richest man in the world, Adnan Khashoggi, who also happened to be the world's preeminent arms dealer, Kessler took on the secretive and mysterious world of espionage. He wrote Spy versus Spy, Stalking Soviet Spies in America, the only book on the FBI's secret counterintelligence program. He wrote about a half a dozen more books on the CIA, KGB, and FBI, including Inside the CIA, Revealing the Secrets of the World's Most Powerful Spy Agency, and which was the only book the agency wrote with CIA's limited cooperation. And then that was followed by the FBI, Inside the World's Most Powerful Law Enforcement Agency. Where do you go from there? Kessler then wrote Inside the White House, The Hidden Lives of the Modern Presidents and the Secrets of the World's Most Powerful Institution, followed by The Sins of the Father, Joseph P. Kennedy and the Dynasty He Founded. Then he went Inside Congress, which gave Kessler's views of how Americans can take back their government by electing decent, honorable people. He wrote another book on the FBI called The Bureau, The Secret History of the FBI, the first book to tell the full story of the FBI from its beginnings in 1908 to the present. Others included The CIA at War and The Terrorist Watch, which finally brings us to the current book, just released this week, and it is another fascinating book. It gets to the heart of an institution that few people know much about. As I mentioned, the book is called In the President's Secret Service, Behind the Scenes with Agents in the Line of Fire and the Presidents They Protect. It reveals what these agents, whose job it is to protect the lives of our presidents and their families, have seen and are now willing to talk about. We're talking sexual habits, temperaments, assassination attempts. The book is fascinating. It's got USA Today described it as the inside scoop on those stern-faced guys who protect the president. Kessler is also the chief Washington correspondent of Newsmax.com. He has won 16 journalism awards, and it is indeed an honor to have him here today. Mr. Kessler, you're with us, I trust, right?
I hope so. Thank you for that wonderful introduction.
Well, thank you. It's a great honor to have you here, and it's really quite an amazing body of work that you have done over these years. So we will get to the new book in a minute, but I wanted to cover a little other ground first, because we're interested in the subject itself of investigative reporting. So how do you approach these subjects like Congress or the White House or the CIA? Do you have a point of view going in, or do you just start by gathering information, conducting interviews, and go wherever it leads you?
Generally, I do it the latter way, and I think that's one reason why I do get cooperation from people, because they realize that I am open-minded and just trying to explore how these agencies work. And in the case of my book about the war on terror called The Terrorist Watch, I did have a somewhat of a point of view, which was that the media was not telling the truth about the changes that President Bush had initiated that have made us safer. But at the same time, I was open-minded about the changes and how they work. So that's I think one reason why I do get cooperation both from agencies and from individuals. They can just look at my work and see what I've done. And beyond that, there are little tricks that I engage in, not really tricks, but and I don't know how effective they are, but I certainly think that timing is very important in terms of when I approach people for interviews, whether I already I don't go in without knowing what I'm after, without having the background. I like to be prepared and show the person that I already know a lot. That certainly helps. I'm very interested in accuracy. I'll actually show a draft of material that I'm planning to use to people who have helped me and whom I trust, because I am interested in accuracy, and I'm happy if they point out, things that could be corrected. I think even when I was in the Washington Post, which was from 1970 to 1985, I would do that sometimes, and the editors would frown on that. I think they're afraid that someone is going to somehow take control or threaten or whatever, but I think it's more important to get it right before the story is published, not after, and have to do a correction. I have been appalled at the way journalism has changed since I was at the Post and the Wall Street Journal. I guarantee you that if we had written stories back then such as appear now, we would have been fired. There's no question. So that's my little approach. But obviously, when it comes to books, I want to sell. It's pure capitalism. People don't pay $26 for a book unless they really want to read it, and that's what I try to do: give them something that. Is both interesting and hopefully about an important subject. I like a challenge. I like the secrecy of these agencies, because very few other journalists can penetrate, and I like that challenge. Maybe I'm perverse, but but it does make for books that are unique, because in the case of the Secret Service, nobody has been able to penetrate before. And the agency actually cooperated on the book, even though, I had written one article in Newsmax that was critical of Secret Service management in a very narrow way about the attrition rate and how it was caused in part by their very senseless transfer policies. But then I got a tip about some other item, and they convinced me that it was wrong, and I didn't write a story, so I assume that impressed them. And they also, I know, checked me out with the FBI and people that they know, and found that I did an honest job. So they cooperated. I was able to interview the director, Mark Sullivan, the top officials, go to the training center, go to some of the secret, in fact, all of the secret operations centers. But at the same time, I was able to talk to both current and former agents who would give me the real skinny. And the real skinny, on the one hand, was how the Secret Service has been cutting corners since Department of Homeland Security took it over, and also what the presidents and the vice presidents and the first families are really like, as seen by these agents who are like human surveillance cameras. They see everything that goes on behind the scenes.
Okay, Ron, we'll come back to that book in just a couple minutes. My co-host, Don Irvine, has a question right now. Don, are you there? Sorry, I don't know why he's not on the air there. But anyway, one thing we wanted to talk about is that I know years ago, and looking back over your career, when you had written your book about Congress, ABC's 2020 had planned to do a story on your book, but then chose to kill it just before it aired. Is that going too far back? Do you remember that story? And
I do. It was very disappointing. And, you know, I know there were complaints by Congress. The piece not only was ready to go, but it had been lawyered. So that tells you something about, you know, the fact that there was pressure applied at the last minute. And, of course, we still see that today. We see shows that don't want to put me on because, you know, they want to get some other person on, or certainly that I have a conservative viewpoint and they don't want to, they just can't stand to have anything in the other direction, anything positive about Bush, for example. So it's a constant battle.
Mm-hmm. Don, are you there? I don't know what's the problem. We haven't had this before. But anyway, so speaking of that, I mean, so you were 15 years at the Washington Post, and as you just pointed out, as a conservative, what was life like as a conservative reporter working at the Washington Post? Were you able to express yourself the way you wanted to, or did you feel
restrained? Actually, I didn't think of myself as a conservative back then. I thought of myself more centrist. Can you hear me?
Well, I'm hearing a little bit of an echo there.
Yeah, there, that's better.
Okay.
I was interested in subjects such as the FBI that you know are of interest to national security conservatives, and I would run into problems with as editors not wanting to run stories that were positive about the FBI even back then. I really turned around at 9/11 and realized that, you know, it's our country that's at stake here, and we can't hide behind so-called objectivity because the media was not telling the truth about the national security issues, and I felt I knew what really goes on, and so I totally turned around at that point.
Mm-hmm. I think Don is with us now, right, Don?
I'm here.
Okay.
Hello.
Right. I think. Hey, how are you doing there, Ron?
Hi.
I think it was trying a new headset, and that may be the problem. Going back a little bit here, my father, Reed, wrote a lot about Soviet and American spies and investigated Soviet penetration of American institutions. How deep was Soviet penetration of our media and our government at its peak, and how did that change after the collapse of the Soviet Union?
It was quite deep. Subsequently, the Verona Papers, as you know, revealed, based on penetration of Soviet codes, just how deep that penetration was, and it certainly was in all aspects of life, and definitely did include the media. But at the same time, you know, there was this. I have to tell you, I wrote a Wall Street Journal op-ed that said that Joe McCarthy was the bad guy that most of the country thinks he was, because based on interviews with FBI people who actually were investigating spies at the time, and other information, you know, I said that that he really gave the cause of investigating espionage a bad name, because he would just make up things and go way beyond what the facts showed. I mean, you know, in other words, the first point is true, that there was tremendous penetration by the Soviets, that liberals were you know, often shills for the Soviet for communists, but at the same time that McCarthy did not help the cause in the long run. I'm sure you don't agree with that, but since you brought it up, I wanted to mention it.
That's more than fair. Another question here. With groups like ProPublica and other sites on the Internet, investigative reporting has changed over the years. How would you characterize the state of investigative reporting in this country, and what advice would you offer?
I think it's pretty much disintegrated. And, you know, what passes for investigative reporting is really very biased reporting, where reporters have a point of view, which is always against Republicans, against conservatives, and that they write stories that are just dishonest, that either suppress the other side or have the other side at the very end of a story. The one example that I cite in my book, The Terrorist Watch, is Tyler Drumheller, a former CIA official in Europe, claimed that the CIA was aware that from a very high Iraqi official that Iraq did not have WMD, but that the Bush White House was not interested in hearing it. So that an interview with him ran on 60 Minutes. It appeared in the Washington Post. After that, the Senate Intelligence Committee did an investigation, looked at all the classified documents, and issued a public report that said that Drumheller was making this up, that actually it was quite the opposite. The person he referred to, the foreign minister of Iraq, actually said the opposite, that Saddam did have WMD. Well, you know, where did that appear? Nowhere. No media picked it up. And in fact, 60 Minutes subsequently did another interview with Drumheller where he made new charges against Bush. The Washington Post and other outlets continued to quote him, never ever mentioning that it turned out he had made this whole story up. Just disgusting to a journalist who, you know, thought that he was joining this profession to tell the truth and help people by doing that. And, you know, what we see over and over again is the media doing the opposite.
Yes. So let's move on to your new book. I know that's what we want to talk about. And first, I recommend people go to your website, ronaldkessler.com, which has a much more detailed biography than I gave, and I'm sure people can purchase your books through that website as well as through Amazon.
Not on the website, but Amazon for sure.
Okay. Well, anyway, I found this book to be fascinating, the history. Just to go back a little bit and help explain the origins of the Secret Service, you write that Lincoln, as his last official act, signed legislation that created the Secret Service. I found that quite ironic. What was the original purpose of the Secret Service, and when did it come into existence?
The original purpose was just to go after counterfeiters, which was a big, big problem, because states would issue their own currency through banks. And nobody even knew what the currency was supposed to look like, because each state had different, and each bank had different versions. So the estimate was that about a third of the currency in the country was counterfeit. So it was established in 1865 to go after counterfeiters. And also, interestingly, about Lincoln, Not many people know that he had one policeman guarding him. He never wanted security in the first place, and he kept resisting it, even though the Civil War was going on. He finally agreed to some policeman guarding him, and this one policeman who was with him at Ford's Theater decided to go off and have a drink at the local tavern. And so when John Wilkes Booth assassinated Ford, there was nobody guarding him whatsoever. And that's, you know, sort of this symbolizes this tension that goes on to this day between, on the one hand, protecting the president, on the other hand, the president's desire to go out and meet the people and greet the people. And one more example of that is JFK did not want Secret Service agents on the rear running boards of his limousine in Dallas. So when Oswald began firing, there was one shot that missed. At that point, if Secret Service agents had been on those rear running boards, they would have definitely jumped on JFK, shielded him from any subsequent bullets, and he would be alive today. So it was JFK's recklessness that contributed to his death, unfortunately. But going back to your question, the Secret Service sort of, in a very haphazard way, came on to guarding the president because they were investigating some counterfeiters in the Midwest, and these people were threatening the president besides being counterfeiters. So the Secret Service started guarding the president, and that's how it all started. But still, Congress was reluctant to provide funds. The press would periodically criticize the idea of guarding the president. They said it was so-called royalism. It was too much like England. So there was always this rocky road on this issue. And as I say, it continues today, where the candidates and presidents will frequently not want the Secret Service nearby, or will want metal detection or magnetometer screening to stop if there are still stragglers outside and the event is about to start. And the expose side of this book in the President's Secret Service, besides the tales of what the presidents are like and the vice presidents are like, is that the Secret Service, since it was taken over by the Department of Homeland Security, it used to be in Treasury, has been cutting corners and bowing to pressure to the point where it actually does not do magnetometer screening frequently when events are about to start, or even they will not do it at all. For example, when Joe Biden threw the first pitch at the Orioles game in April, the Secret Service did no screening of any of the people in the audience, and that's just unheard of. I interviewed Secret Service agents and officials up to the level of deputy director who had been there before Homeland Security took it over, and they said, that's unbelievable. We would never allow that on our watch. And it's just common sense. You know, a person, a gunman could come in, terrorists could come in with weapons, with grenades, with impunity if you don't have metal detection, as you do at airports. It's so basic, and really you're talking about protecting democracy, because if a president can be assassinated, we don't have democracy.
One more question on from the earlier days. It apparently took three presidents being assassinated before the Secret Service began protecting the president, right? Lincoln, Garfield, and McKinley.
Exactly, and it was this. You know, even after I think Garfield's assassination, the New York Herald Tribune editorialized that we shouldn't have any increased protection. You know, this is just fairyland. And I maintain that the Secret Service's current budget of $1.4 billion, which includes about half of that for the investigative side, which is not only counterfeiting but all kinds of other financial fraud crimes, ATM fraud crimes, is ridiculously small when given how important the Secret Service is. That's the price of one half of a stealth bomber compares with a stimulus package of over $700 billion. And yet, you know, the life of the president is in the hands of Secret Service agents, who, by the way, are very brave and dedicated. And I say in the book that FBI agents admire Secret Service agents above any other law enforcement. But it's the management, the Secret Service management, that's been cutting corners.
The next thing I think what we want to get into is quick little summaries of the Secret Service opinion and stories on each of, or, you know, most of the recent presidents. But my question leading into that is that a lot of these agents were willing to go on the record to talk to you. Are they not violating any sort of confidentiality agreements when they talk about, say, the sexual dalliances of President Kennedy, who you spoke about as being reckless, but tell us about in that regard as well.
Yeah, they are violating an understanding. It's not in writing, but some, you know, say on the record that they feel that the public should know these things. That we elect our leaders, and we, as with any employee that we hire, we should know about their character and if they're engaged in duplicitous conduct, and that's something we should know, and so that we can make an informed judgment. So that's one motive, and of course, in addition, I, you know, hopefully just got their trust, and so about half the quotes in the book are on the record.
So how reckless was Kennedy as far as his sexual dalliances?
You know, he was just constantly involved in scoring with women, and I have some descriptions, for example, of Fiddle and Faddle, who were two assistants in the White House, and they would have threesomes. And one Secret Service agent says on the record that he witnessed Fiddle and Faddle wearing just white T-shirts, their nipples showing through, nothing else, swimming in the White House pool with JFK, and the Jackie's detail warned his detail that Jackie was coming back unexpectedly, and so they all scrambled out of the pool. There also, Jackie's press secretary Pamela Tenner was having an affair with JFK. So it was just constant. And of course, the press, you know, picked up little tidbits about it, but never wrote anything about it.
So what about LBJ? Tell us. It's kind of amazing what you found out about him or what they told you. So
yeah.
Tell us a little about that, and we'll keep moving on through the president.
LBJ, you know, was even more crude than JFK. He was he would have sex with a lot of his secretaries, with the wife of one of his best friends at his ranch. But he was also just out of control. For example, he would, when he got in Air Force One, stripped naked in front of his daughters, in front of his wife, in front of female secretaries. And he would urinate in front of female reporters at his ranch. One time he was late for an appointment with JFK when he was vice president, and he told the Secret Service agent driving him to drive up on the sidewalk where there were pedestrians during rush hour in order to get there faster. Well, the agent said no. LBJ hit him on the head with a newspaper and said, "You're fired." You know, half the time he was drunk. One time, some rare roast beef was being served on Air Force One, and Jack Valenti took his platter, and LBJ looked at it and said, "That's raw meat." And he said to the steward, "You don't serve raw meat on my plane." And he took the platter and he threw it on the floor, gravy and all. Jack Valenti then went off and said to the steward, "You know, could you please give me some more of that rare roast beef?" So one time, Lady Bird happened to walk into the Oval Office when LBJ was having sex with the secretary, and LBJ blew up at the Secret Service for allowing her in, and insisted on an alarm system to warn him in the future if she was coming.
This is Don again. Did you uncover anything new about Nixon?
Quite a bit. Nothing, you know, incredibly shocking, but just how strange he was. For example, one time he was at San Clemente and agents were watching him watch TV and Nixon was feeding his dog biscuits. And then he took one of the biscuits, he looked at it, and he put it in his mouth and he ate it. Another time, he loved to have fireplaces all year round, and so another time Nixon was making a fire in the fireplace at San Clemente, he forgot to close the or open the flue damper. All this black smoke started to fill the house. Two agents came running. One of them said, "Where's the son of a bitch?" And then from the other room, they heard, "Son of a bitch is over here. I'm trying to find matching socks." And I don't know if that last part was actually a joke, but anyway, his grandson David Eisenhower was thought of by the Secret Service as the most clueless protectee that they had ever had. One time, he asked agents to help him because the light on his garage door opener was not going on. They looked at it and they saw that there was no light bulb in the opener. Another time, David Eisenhower bought a new car and decided to drive it right across the country to see his grandmother, Mamie Eisenhower. And around Phoenix, it stopped. So he had it towed to a car dealer. He had to stay overnight. And the next morning, he called the car dealer to see what the problem was. Was it fixed? They said, "Yeah, it's fixed. It was out of gas." He had never filled it up a second time with gasoline. and some more stories about him. But Pat Nixon was an alcoholic, and really after they left the White House, he got worse. And one agent said that he was guarding San Clemente one day, and he heard this, and it was at night. He heard this rustling in the bushes, and he cocked his shotgun, and it turned out that it was Pat Nixon on her knees, drunk, trying to find the house. Very sad.
Listen, we unfortunately just have a couple minutes left with you. I mean, we'd love to get into details about Clinton and Obama and Bush, but I just want to give
and
you
Reagan.
The last,
Reagan was
and Reagan,
enduring.
Of course, but if you can give us like maybe 30 seconds on each of them, we're going to have to wrap it up at that point, and then we want to plug your book one last time.
Thank you. Reagan was a very endearing figure, just as nice as he appeared to be. And one time he came out of the house with a pistol, and the agent said, "What's that for?" And he said, "Well, just in case you guys need any help." But Jimmy Carter was the most phony president of all. He would pretend to carry his own luggage, but it was actually empty. Obama actually does treat his agents well, treats them with respect, but he is still smoking despite his claims that he gave it up 95%. Barbara and Jenna Bush gave the Secret Service a hard time. Jenna would go through red lights trying to evade the Secret Service. Chelsea Clinton actually was the best protectee when it comes to first family members. Spiro Agnew was having an affair, which is described in the book. And the Bushes were wonderful with the Secret Service, both Bushes and Laura. An endearing story about Bush 41 is when he was vice president, the Secret Service agents would sneak into the kitchen at the vice president's residence in the middle of the night to steal the chocolate chip cookies that the stewards would make. And one agent was there looking for the cookies at 3 a.m. and he heard this voice behind him, "Where are the cookies?" And it was Bush 41, and they went looking for the cookies and they had them together. Quite a few interesting stories about Bush, including
great. Ron, I hate to cut you off, but everyone can hear, this is a fascinating book. There's tons of these stories on all these presidents that I highly recommend this, and thank you so much for being with us, and we will be in touch, maybe have you back again. We could spend a lot more time with you. And the book, again, is called In the President's Secret Service, and you can find it on Amazon. The author, again, Ronald Kessler, been very generous with his time.
Well, thank you so much,
Ron.
I really enjoyed it.
Take care. Thank
Bye.
You. Okay.
Our next guest is Todd Shepard. I believe he's on the line. Todd is an investigative reporter with the Independence Institute in Colorado.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Hi, Todd.
Doing great.
Good.
Why don't you start out telling us about your organization, the Independence Institute, and about you and your role with them.
Sure. The Independence Institute is a free market-based think tank. So I guess you might say, excuse me here, we're similar to Heritage or Cato, just on a, but we work on state issues. So we're a state-based free market think tank. And a year ago, the Independence Institute made the decision to hire an investigative reporter, and that was me. The reasoning behind that was, at the time, of course, similar to what's happening really all across America, newsrooms, TV newsrooms were cutting back on their staff tremendously. In particular, we had seen already here in Denver, we had seen a lot of cutbacks in newsroom staff, and it really was sort of a prelude, if you will, to the demise of the Rocky Mountain News. And so from the Independence Institute's point of view, the analysis was, if all these newsrooms are going to be cutting back, probably the low-hanging fruit in terms of making those cuts is to get rid of their investigative units because they're very expensive in terms of the reporters. They're expensive in terms of gathering documents, and your investigative unit may only give you a good story once every month or once every other month, and so it doesn't add that much to the daily churn of selling newspapers. And so the Independence Institute thought, we can't let investigative reporting wither on the vine. We'll hire our own investigative reporter. Just a little bit about me. I had 5 years of radio experience before I came here to work at the Independence Institute. The last three of those working for the major 50,000-watt AM news talk station here in Denver, 850 KOA. And I had broken several stories in the last year to 18 months I was at KOA, and really this was a natural fit for me and a natural fit for the Independence Institute.
And I believe you have a radio show called Independence Investigates. What is that about?
Well, I don't actually do a radio show. I have an independent page within the Independence Institute website, and that's where I post all of my reports. Just published one yesterday about how the Office of Economic Development here in Colorado spent $47,000 on unoccupied rental property, so that it will be unoccupied for 18 months, and they paid $47,000 for it. So small things like that, of course, So Independence Investigates is the separate page on the Independence Institute website by which I publish my stories.
Todd, earlier this year, President Obama came to Colorado and talked about the solar panels on top of the Denver Museum of Science.
Right.
What was he doing there, and what got your attention?
Well, as the stimulus bill was being hurried through, and this part is a little bit of speculation on my part, but it seems to fit with the timeline fairly well. As the stimulus bill was being finalized in Congress, it wasn't exactly clear whether or not it would have the momentum to pass. And I think the president had begun to outline a sort of bully pulpit tour, if you will, and the first stop of that was going to be Denver. And then the bill actually got passed a day or two earlier than anyone suspected. And so the president's office, I believe, and again, I admit that this is conjecture on my part at this point, said, well, as long as we've got the stop in Denver planned, and I think there was also sort of a homecoming feeling to it since this was where the Democratic National Convention had been, that, well, why don't we just go ahead and plan the bill signing for Denver, and let's scout a good location. So they picked the Denver Museum of Nature and Science because they had recently installed several new solar panels on top of the museum to help cut the museum's cost. And I know that that probably didn't get a lot of national attention because most of the national attention was on the was on the stimulus bill itself, as it should have been. But as I was reading an article in the Denver Post, there was a sentence that caught my eye, and it said, "The sun on the rooftop is enough to power 30 homes." And the first thing is that sentence struck me as being horribly out of context. It doesn't tell you how much sun, how many days of sun has to be collected on the rooftop to power 30 homes. It doesn't tell you how long those 30 homes would be powered. Is it for a day? Is it for a week or for a month? And so based on those questions, I essentially went to the museum and I said, show me your last 24 months of electric bills. And they denied me that request. And they, in fact, have the statutory authority to deny me those requests because they're quasi-governmental. So based on that, I continued to do a little bit more digging, and I just happened to come across an article by the Denver Business Journal. And I was very fortunate that the vice president of operations basically laid the statistics out on the table. And he said that the cost of the solar array was $720,000 and that it would not, and they were thinking about buying the solar panels themselves. But he said when we did the math analysis, we realized that these panels wouldn't pay for themselves for 110 years.
That's startling. How do they justify it?
Well, in the end, you see, they don't have to justify it because they didn't buy it. What they did was they found an outside buyer, and the outside buyer, unlike the museum, is able to receive and is able to harvest tax incentives and tax subsidies for being the owner of these solar panels. And so these were subsidies and breaks that the museum as a nonprofit was not qualified to receive, but an individual or an outside corporation is able to receive. So although they weren't able to justify it, someone else was able to buy it because of the tax shelter that it provided, essentially. And what that really means, I think we all know here, is that if the museum didn't buy it and it's being subsidized largely by federal subsidies, then that means all of us, the American taxpayers, bought these solar panels for $720,000, again, won't generate enough electricity to pay for themselves for 110 years. And I also might add that the average life span of a solar panel is somewhere between 25 and 30 years.
And didn't you also find out how much power, electricity, that the panels were going to give to the museum?
Right. The museum told me initially that they when they denied my request for the electric bills, they did say that they said that the solar panels produce less than 5% of the building's needs. And then I was told later that that should be modified to say the solar panels can provide anywhere from 2 to 12% of the museum's needs at any moment, given on the weather and the conditions and so forth. But I think the 5% average is close to what the, is sort of an average of what they experience over the course of a year, given the cloudy days, the snowy days, and the averaging that in with the high productivity days as well. But I think what interests me is yesterday, Governor Ritter, the governor of Colorado, had a very large donation of space on the op-ed page of the Denver Post, where he was once again extolling the virtues of the green economy. And he said, you know, solar and wind are going to prevent us from having to create these expensive power plants. And it ran through my mind, well, if these solar panels present only 5% of the museum's total energy needs, you would have to pay $14 million in solar panels, $14 million just to provide electricity for this single building on the east side of Denver. Now what's expensive? And to be able to provide some of these cost breakdowns to the public, I think, is crucial.
One more question on the solar panels. The museum is not the only place they've got a fairly large array. I believe there's a pretty large spread over there at the airport.
There is a fairly large spread over there at the airport. And you know what? I talked about that when I gave a presentation a couple of days back, that You know, being green is very high, or having an appearance of being green is very high on Denver's priority. And so they had a huge installation of solar panels that have been installed right adjacent to Denver International Airport. And trust me, the airport property is thousands upon thousands of acres. It's enormous. And actually, most of it is unused. Most of it is wheat fields, in fact. But what's interesting about the positioning of these solar panels is, out of those thousands upon thousands of acres, they made sure that they were positioned right next to one of the main drives into the terminal so that you have to see it when you come in. They were not going to let this public relations opportunity escape them by perhaps putting the solar panels out in one of the wheat fields. Instead, they wanted it right where everyone could see it. And they also finished that installation right before the Democratic National Convention. A couple of interesting things about that. First of all, they were in such a rush to install it before the Democratic National Convention, such that all the delegates would see it, that for the first month that the solar panels were out there, they were inactive. They were not hooked up. So when all the delegates arrived for the convention, although they saw this beautiful solar array, it was not working, and it didn't work for the first 30 days. The second thing that's interesting about this is I have a good friend in town who's also an investigative reporter. He runs a website called facethestate.com, and he published a story just 2 days ago about how Denver International Airport did not properly bid out the work for the solar panels. What happened was those solar panels were originally bid and were going to go in at the Denver jail, and then at the last minute someone said, no, put them over at the airport, and they didn't go through the standard bidding process. They just took all of the work that the sheriff's office had did, and they just shoved it over to the airport. Whether or not that includes some illegalities, we'll be finding out in the next month or so. But I find it pretty interesting that a number of procedural rules that are in place to prevent fraud and to prevent a number of other things, a number of those procedural rules were completely ignored for that solar array at the airport.
Well, this is fascinating. I certainly remember when President Obama was there and extolling the green economy, and it's interesting that the New York Times and the mainstream media aren't doing these investigations that you are to show that basically, you know, what they're talking about really is pretty empty, I think, and really not very accurate as far as, you know, the promise of this green economy. What do you think of that? I mean, the mainstream media coverage and the overall promise of this green economy versus the reality as you're discovering it.
Right. Well, I think it comes down to whether or not, and we've all heard the sort of surveys over the last 10 or 20 years about how the majority of mainstream reporters are registered Democrats and so forth. I'd be interested to know what percentage of mainstream reporters believe in anthropogenic global warming, because if they do, then it at least explains why they may not have some curiosity to at least attempt an apples-to-apples comparison when it comes to energy. But the second part of that equation is making an apples-to-apples comparison can still be very difficult because, again, as I experienced, I just happened to be lucky that the Denver Museum had actually sort of vomited out that information a year before I began my investigation. Had they not, I would have been stumped because they didn't owe me that information. I can still get other information on the solar array at the federal campus here in Denver or the solar array out at Denver or out at the International Airport, which, by the way, that's a $14 million solar array, and it produces less than 2% of the electric needs of Denver International Airport. So you're right. I think more of those comparisons need to be done, but the problem is the subsidy structure and the tax break structure is so Byzantine and so complicated, unless you almost have a PhD in reading electric bills, it's just very, very complicated to do. So it's just difficult. The one other thing that I, would definitely upbraid the media for not making an issue of, when I first published my story on the Denver solar panels on top of the museum, I showed how essentially on every Xcel bill, if you're an Xcel customer in Colorado, I show you the line item where you pay for those solar panels and energy projects like that. And of all people, Democrats, so I'm led to believe by their words, are abhorred by, or by, you know, they hate regressive taxation. Trust me, if every Xcel customer in Colorado is paying between $1 to $2 every month to fund these kinds of energy projects, that's regressive taxation. It's abhorrently so. And so the last thing I'd mention is a good friend of mine brought me a newsletter by a guy down in Pueblo who happens to be sort of a rocket scientist. He PhD in electrical engineering and so forth. And he does do investigations of this style. As I watch Colorado Rockies games on the base, on TV here, that there's a commercial where they say these solar panels, and there are some solar panels out by the ballpark, they say the solar panels will collect enough energy to power the scoreboard for 1 year. And this gentleman who keeps this newsletter down in Pueblo, he said, I did the math, and he said the power plant that's closest to my home, he said it takes that power plant 7 seconds to produce the energy to run that scoreboard for 7 seconds. So the solar panels need a full year of sunlight to produce a full year of scoreboard. The power plant needs 7 seconds, and it's done. So I thought that was a kind of a humorous comparison.
Okay, we've got a few more things we want to cover, but one thing I noticed you did an investigation earlier this year on the Customs and Border Patrol and some sort of strange disappearances around there. Could you give us a brief overview of that, and then we want to get into a couple of other things as well.
Sure, you bet. If you just go into Google and type in, excuse me, Homeland Security, lose two forklifts, or Homeland Security, lose two forklifts, I promise you, you'll come up with my story. But I had asked the Department of Homeland Security to show me all of their most recent inventories of lost, stolen, and damaged equipment. And after receiving all of those, they were all pretty eye-popping, if you ask me, but none more so than the Customs and Border Patrol. Their inventory of lost, stolen, and damaged goods was a 58 or 59 page document with about 30 entries per page. The amount of cameras, night vision goggles, night vision cameras, computers, desktop computers, laptop computers, and other equipment that was inventoried as lost is simply astonishing. And once you look through, it's just not enough for me to say on that inventory they lost two forklifts. That's funny, but when you look through that inventory page by page, your jaw will start to drop open. And really what it looks to me like is, I would be highly suspicious that there is insider theft going on at Customs and Border Patrol. And in fact, after we published this story, we sent the full inventory to all of 9 of Colorado's congressional delegates and asked them to investigate what we thought was potential theft at CBP.
Okay. Todd, how do you investigate or you choose to subjects you want to investigate? And also, I know that you seem to be have used the Freedom of Information Act and the Open Records Act. Now, how does it all play into your investigations?
You know, that's the first part of that question is a great one, because part of what I have to do is not only do I investigate government fraud, waste, and corruption, but I have to try and pick spots where I think the mainstream media isn't already investigating. So, for example, when the Democratic National Convention was here last August, I did almost zero small, quick investigations into some things that were going on. Neither of those panned out, and I moved on quickly. Because my thought was, and the Rocky Mountain News was still alive at this time, my thought was, well, between the Rocky Mountain News and the Denver Post, they're going to be scouring for sensational stories having to do with the DNC all day long. So I can't spend my time there. So otherwise, I just look for government agencies that might get a fleeting mention in the paper, the sort of government agency that you've maybe never heard of. And that's where I'll start to just send out some simple open records requests and say, hey, show me all of your recent audits. Show me all of your checkbook for the last 6 months. Show me all of your consultant payments you've made over the last 6 months. For example, I just got a spreadsheet from the governor's energy office showing how much they've paid to consultants over the last 3 years, and it totals up to $5 million. I find that very interesting, and I'm just now starting to look into what all of that consulting money is going to. So really, Open Records Act requesting, especially the Colorado Open Records Act request, that is my main weapon, and I probably file between 5 and 10 Open Records Act requests per day.
Wow, per day. So yeah. This is sort of a new media approach to investigative journalism on the web, on your radio show. Is this different from investigative reporting if you were working for a daily newspaper or a major magazine? I mean, tell us about the difference in sort of the, you know, what's happening with investigative journalism today.
You know, I think it would be very similar to the kind of investigative journalism you would find in a daily newspaper, especially 30 or 40 years ago. But I think the big difference between the investigative journalism I'm doing today versus the kind of investigative journalism that is done at most print organizations is really what we consider a story in the first place. So, for example, the other day I did an analysis of several 911 agencies in Colorado. And on your cell phone bill, again, you get this little 70-cent tax by your county, and this is what provides for all of your 911 services. This is what pays for the dispatch center and the people that answer the phone calls. And heavens knows I'm not against 911 agencies at all, but of course they still need oversight. Well, as I looked at these agencies, I found that all while you know, the state's in debt, the city of Denver is running a deficit. While all of these agencies are running deficits, these 911 agencies are all sitting on a stockpile of cash. In particular, the county from which I work, I'm in Golden, Colorado, so I'm in Jefferson County, and I just got a new audit of theirs yesterday. Jefferson County 911 services turned a $2.5 million profit last year. They only had $2.5 million of expenses, but they pulled in $5 million in taxes. So is that a story? From the Independence Institute's point of view, absolutely. It's over taxation, and that is a story that ought to be of concern to citizens. From the mainstream media's point of view, I don't think they consider over taxation that much of a story, at least certainly not as much of a story as a government running a deficit or a government that's facing a shortfall. And so if you can see the difference between why our organization thinks overtaxation is a story versus why the mainstream media doesn't, then I think that illustrates a great deal as to why the brand of investigative journalism I'm doing is different than what might be going on at the Denver Post.
Hey, Todd, thank you for joining us. We're just about out of time, and want to give our listeners your website before we sign off.
Sure. The Independence Institute website is just independenceinstitute.org. If you scroll a little bit down towards the bottom of the page, you'll find the Independence Investigates logo. Click on that, and it will take you to the page where I've got all of my stories. One, I know we're running out of time, but one quick thing I'll mention, too, is did an investigation back in January or February of the state's Homeland Security. I found missing ATVs, found a million-dollar check that had been in a defunct mailbox for 6 months. So Homeland Security is ripe for investigating in any state. No, doesn't matter where you are. Homeland Security has been fairly inefficient ever since they've been brought around. So that's a good area for any investigative reporter to look into, regardless of the state.
Well, great. Once again, thank you, Todd, for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks so much, gentlemen.
All right.
Bye-bye.
And that wraps it up for our show today. We want to thank Sarah Norton for producing our show today. And also want to remind everyone to please tune in again next week. We have a special guest, Michelle Malkin, and we'll be discussing her book, The Culture of Corruption. And that is the end of Take Aim.
Thank you, everyone. We'll see you next week on the radio.